Good morning and welcome to Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm your host, Ty Bannerman. Lobbyists spent more than $195,000 on events, meals, and giveaways for state legislators during the last legislative session. That's more than $6,000 a day. Ethics advocates worry that this kind of spending influences those legislators' decisions in the roundhouse and think that the public should have a right to know exactly what's going on. We'll be talking about lobbying, as well as the state's new ethics commission, and how a plan to pay New Mexico's legislators a salary might help reduce the role lobbyists play in state government. And we want to hear from you. Are you concerned about the ways that certain industries use lobbyists to influence state government? Or do you see it as a necessary stopgap that allows time-crunched legislators to learn about important issues? Do you think a salary for legislators would help decrease their reliance on lobbyists? Or do you think that the state legislature should remain a civilian body? Call us at 277-5866, email letstalk@kunm.org, or tweet us at #letstalknm. Joining us in the studio, I'd like to welcome Kathleen Sabo, Executive Director of New Mexico Ethics Watch, and I should point out, former longtime host of this very program. Welcome back to the studio, Kathleen.
Hey, thanks, Ty. Great to be here.
So New Mexico's Secretary of State released filings showing that lobbyists have spent more than $195,000 on events and giveaways for legislators during the last 30 days session. Can you tell me a bit about what these events and gifts are like and why New Mexico Ethics Watch sees them as a problem?
Well, first, they run the gamut of what the expenses cover. It could be anything from $28,000 for golf passes to a $200 dinner. And the issue is, most people report things, but the issue is sometimes they're either undervalued, like potentially ski passes or golf passes, or there's just not enough information that's given to know why this event is occurring, who's attending it, and what the purpose is.
Now, what kind of industries are these or interests are these lobbyists representing?
Again, runs the gamut. Could be the American Cancer Society. Could be oil and gas company like Chevron. Could be Every Town for Gun Safety. You just you don't know until you look.
Mm-hmm. And are they required to report every expenditure?
They are required to report most expenditures. During the legislative session, if they spend more than $500, they're required to file a report within 48 hours of that timing.
And who are the biggest spenders?
Well, you know, again, you're going to see a $28,000 expense. This is reported in a story in The New Mexican by Jen Schooled and Michael Gerstein. You're going to see a $28,000 expense by the so-called Golf Tourism Alliance, which Jens and Michael have now sort of determined maybe doesn't even exist. But you're also going to see people like Conservation Voters Alliance spending $17,000 on a dinner for legislators and other elected officials.
So it's not necessarily a partisan issue on the right or left.
Absolutely not. Everybody's in on it. And I want to say this. I think this is really important to understand that most people are playing by the rules. What groups like New Mexico Ethics Watch and other good government groups are saying, these are bad rules. They need to be tightened up. We need more transparency.
Now, can you tell me a little bit about how this spending might translate to influence over a legislator?
Well, you know, the easiest way to sort of communicate it is it seems like human nature. Somebody does something nice for you, you're going to have goodwill toward them. Okay, that's one way. That's the simplest way to understand it. The other way is access. You know, concentrated access at a small dinner. And you know, I know we're going to get into this more about reform of the legislature, but a lot of legislators depend upon lobbyists to help educate them on complex issues because it's not a full-time legislature, because there's not, you know, full-time professional staff. So, again, you know, the access, the time, the dependence, you know, to educate all leads to this sense of goodwill. And that's really what people are trying to engender. If you go up to the Capitol and you see the lobbyists, they're very good-natured, you know, happy, I'm going to help you out people, and it's very collegial up there.
So this is not, you know, you might be picturing while you're listening a briefcase full of cash. This is not what we're talking about here at all. This is really just people coming in, speaking to the legislators, maybe taking them to dinner or something like that.
I doubt there's a briefcase full of cash. but yeah, you know, inviting the legislator and you know, analysts or to a dinner and then potentially expecting something in return.
Now, as you said, most of this is legal. Certainly what we're talking about right now is perfectly legal, and there are reporting requirements. What information are lobbyists required to disclose?
Well, they're required. It's very minimal. So what they're required to disclose is the date of the event. I'm trying to pull up a form here in a minute. The date of the event, the name of the payee, the beneficiary, the purpose for which the expense happened, and then who potentially they made the expenditure for, and then groups invited. And you're going to see it's going to run the gamut of how much is reported. Sometimes very little. Sometimes a huge amount.
And in your view, what information is lacking?
Well, what we don't know how the expenses that are listed break down. There's no expenses broken down for alcohol, for food and beverage, for, you know, any kind of swag. We just don't know. Groups invited. That's, you know, it might just say legislators, several legislators. And we don't know. Republicans, Democrats, committee members. We just don't know. Now, this is stuff that's required on the form. Mm-hmm. What's not required on the form is why are you talking to them? Mm-hmm. What piece of legislation or pieces of legislation are you working on that you might have an opportunity to talk with a legislator or another elected official about?
And what in New Mexico Ethics Watch New Mexico Ethics Watch's view. What are the next steps to kind of make sure that this isn't so much of a problem in the legislature?
Well, I mean, the best thing that could happen would be a reform of the Lobbyist Regulation Act, where in law rather than in rule, because we know that, you know, it can be problematic if rules say one thing and not specifically in the law, but in law requiring more specificity. Like I said, you know, what legislation are you working on? What are you lobbying them on? You know, and then various other reforms like a moratorium, you know, so you don't have a revolving door and you don't all of a sudden have the former president pro tem of the Senate, you know, lobbying his buddies on his or her buddies on an issue.
Now, where does simply... You know, we talked about the fact that they are advocating for specific issues. If I go to the Capitol and speak to one of my legislators, I'm advocating for that specific issue. But when does that become lobbying?
Well, there is a specific definition, and of course, I can't find it at the moment. But, you know, it's going to cross the line when you're doing it professionally. When you're attempting to influence, and I'll find that definition later on, but when you're attempting to influence and it's a professional job of yours, then you're going to cross the line.
We are taking your comments today. Do you see lobbying at the Capitol as a problem? Do you have questions about how lobbying is reported? Give us a call at 277-5866. Email us at letstalk@kunm.org. or tweet to hashtag #LetsTalkNM. Now, you mentioned that the fact that we have a citizens legislature here, meaning that our legislators are not paid a salary, may be contributing to the influence that lobbyists have. Could you talk a little bit more about why that might be?
Well, again, it's not a couple of things. So they get a per diem. It's expensive to be in Santa Fe. So your per diem might cover your lodging, but it might not cover your meals. So are you going to potentially want to go out to dinner when it's offered? Yeah, you are. Is it at a nice place? Sure. Let's go. And again, I'm not ascribing any impure motive here. Mm-hmm. Just saying this is how the access is achieved and why it's achieved. So that's number one. Number two, again, no full-time professional staff are very, very limited, to help educate. So there's a complex telecommunications bill. You want to learn about it. So are you going to take advantage of, you know, one-on-one or small group time? You probably are. And again, this is where the goodwill, the human nature to want to return a favor might creep in. And, you know, it's hard. We can't get inside the minds of individual people. I mean, mm-hmm. there have been, you know, certain people who have run afoul of the law, and they're easy to see. But again, it's just you got to think about human nature.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell me about some types of lobbying that you've personally, you know, witnessed or are aware of that maybe edges up against that line?
Well, you know, part of my experience is I worked up at the Capitol. I was the head majority analyst for the Senate. I was an analyst in the Judiciary Committee. So I've got some stories, and I'll just tell you, you know, one that really sticks out at me, and I'm not sure I could even name names.
Sure.
But when people started years ago coming in with alternative energy related bills, and I think I was the low person on the totem pole on the staff, and so they'd come to me, and then next thing you know, PNM lobbyists would be in talking with the chair of the committee, and I'm sure there was a great deal of discussion to try to tamp down these alternative energy proposals because PNM wasn't yet prepared to participate them mm-hmm. in to reap benefits. So, you know, I hate to be cynical at all, but these are the kinds of things I saw happen.
Looks like we have a call from Bill in Los Lunas. Good morning, Bill.
Yes, good morning.
What is your question or comment today?
Every individual has the right to lobby their public servants. However, when it comes to a professional lobbying firm, that's a whole ball game, a whole different ball game. Professional firms can put 15 agents out to lobby your representatives on a particular hot topic issue. So it's important to understand that they get 15 hours if they put 15 agents on that particular issue of representative time. When you, as an individual, go and lobby a representative, you get, hopefully, an hour. And that's where that discrepancy is. Thank you for my time.
And thank you for calling, Bill. Is what Bill is describing an accurate representation of what happens?
Well, Bill makes a great point. If you go up as a citizen, you might go up one day. If you're a lobbyist, you're going to be there continually with continuous access. And sometimes the numbers are staggering. We're going to release in a few weeks another report on the oil and gas industry and lobbying and contributions. And one thing we found, and that's in conjunction with Common Cause, one thing we found is that over a certain time period, there were 90 different lobbyists who were lobbying on behalf of the oil and gas industry. So, you know, someone doesn't get along with one legislator, send in the next person. So Bill's right. It's big business.
Now, I have an email comment from Chris in the North Valley of Albuquerque. He says that he believes the part-time legislature is dysfunctional and stands in the way of progress in New Mexico. Says the public might think it means there's no incentive for being in politics for money or power, but that it actually leads to the opposite. The fact that people can't be paid for their work and leaves that work only to those who are independently wealthy or in the bribes, kickback, benefits, and power. He says that being a lifetime politician should be an honorable profession, not a volunteer position. And we are now going to be taking a break. This is Let's Talk New Mexico on 89.9 KUNM. I'm Ty Bannerman, and we are taking a look at the end of the legislative session. And we want to know how you feel about lobbying in New Mexico. Call us at 277-5866 and let us know.
Support comes from Rothstein Donatelli Law Firm, providing legal advice and representation for Native American tribes, people facing criminal charges, expungement of criminal records, civil rights plaintiffs, and survivors of sexual abuse. RossDaneLaw.com.
Support provided by Weekly Alibi, Albuquerque's news weekly and a source for local news, arts, entertainment, and culture. On stands every Thursday or at alibi.com.
The longest-running musical organization in the country came about due to an act of Congress in 1798. The U.S. Marine Band celebrated their 220th anniversary recently with a new piece by Peter Boyer. Music to celebrate the rich history of the Marine Band on the next Performance Today from APM.
Weekday mornings at 9 on KUNM.
Welcome back to Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm Ty Bannerman. Now, I'd like to bring into the conversation former Republican State Representative Jim Dines. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning. How are you doing?
We're doing great here. So during your 4 years in the state legislature, you were known for your refusal to accept any kind of lobbying gift at all, including so much as a cup of coffee. Can you tell me about why you decided to take this position?
Certainly. When I ran for office, it was asked to run for office. This was the first time I'd ever run for public office, and I thought that this would set a good example to show the public and to show others in the legislature and around the state that this didn't have to be some kind of a gifting program to be a legislator. And therefore, I was very concerned about how the public perceives politicians and elected officials. And, you know, the appearance of impropriety goes a long way in, I think, discrediting what is done in the legislature and legislators themselves. And so I wanted to stay away from even the appearance of impropriety. And quite frankly, it was well received by a lot of folks in my district and also around the state.
Can you tell me a little bit from your firsthand viewpoint, what is lobbying like when you're actually in the state legislature?
Well, I was never exposed to it before. I think it was very interesting to see the workings a lot behind the scenes. And at first, when I was up there, because of my position of not taking money or any gifts from lobbyists, there was a standoffish kind of approach, I think, by lobbyists wondering, you know, whether I was even going to talk to people. But as I mentioned to them and others, I was certainly available to talk at any time about New Mexico interest, but it didn't take a gift or any kind of urging through dinners or otherwise to get my a meeting with me. And so what I found is that the lobbyists, because they provide, as was mentioned earlier, they provide resources to legislators. They're heavily used, and I felt much of the time that the lobbyists were pretty much in control of what was going on within the legislature because of that influence and the ability to put boots on the ground to give information to a legislator. But I'll end by saying, you know, nothing comes free. And that was always my concern, is that if there was a bill being proposed by a lobbyist, it was certainly because of that lobbyist's client, and you had to be circumspect about it. And I also agree clearly and very firmly that there needs to be more staffing for legislators, because we had nobody. You had somebody during the session who simply answered the phone and scheduled meetings with you.
Now, are you aware of any other legislators who took a position similar to yours?
I think there was one, I don't remember who it was, took a partial position. But as far as taking nothing, even down to the cup of coffee that you mentioned, there was nobody during my 4 years that did that.
Now, you are also or were also a major advocate for government transparency. Did that extend to the actions of lobbyists as well?
Oh, yes. I felt that because of my strong support of transparency over the years and successfully doing that in court, that there needed to be more transparency with what the lobbyists were doing, such as was mentioned earlier, what bills were they working on? What are they being paid by whom? And that the more transparency, therefore, the more accountability that would be helpful for the public to know exactly what's going on behind closed doors.
Now, I have a comment from Rashad in Albuquerque, who would like to know, how much is being spent on lobbyists' salaries Kathleen, is this something that you might have access to?
No, we don't. And it's, you know, we can know what state agencies, like universities, are paying for their lobbyists. That's a matter of public record. But in terms of what private companies are paying, we have absolutely no idea. There's anecdotal word going around about high salaries, high contract amounts. You know, we just don't know. We don't know that information.
And I have a call from Willard in Albuquerque. Good morning, Willard. Willard, are
you
there?
Good morning.
Hi, what is your question or comment today?
Okay, I'm on the New Mexico Campaign Finance Information System website, and I'm looking at the information that's available, and I'm kind of confused about there's not much detail here. There's one area that shows the number of employers, expenditures, and contributions, but it does not list the employers nor their individual contributions. And I'm looking for, I'm trying to understand where would I get that specific detail.
Jim, is this the kind of thing that you're speaking about when it comes to transparency?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the question.
Oh, that's is what Willard is describing, the lack of detail on the campaign finance website, is this the sort of lack of transparency that you're speaking about?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that New Mexico Ethics Watch has done a nice job analyzing the lack of the transparency in that area and has made some suggestions to clarify some of that. But the more that we could have, the better it would be, because then you can trace the money.
And Kathleen, would you like to respond to Willard?
Yeah, Willard, so what you are encountering is something we've encountered a lot, which is the dysfunction of this campaign finance information system. And in our reports, we, you know, suggest, like, please get this together. Now, we know that the Secretary of State's office is perennially understaffed and underfunded, but they did receive money to update this system, and we are going to meet with them along with other good government groups and, you know, tell them exactly the problems we encountered. You practically need a tutorial on how to approach this system, and this is the public information system. So, Willard, I can't give you that tutorial right now on the air, but you are welcome to call me. You can look me up on our website and call me, and I can walk through some things with you at a later time.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your call, Willard. We are taking your calls this morning. Do you think that more lawmakers should take a position against accepting lobbyist contributions of food or gifts? Call us at 277-5866 or email us at letstalk@kunm.org. Now, former Representative Jim Dines, during your time in the legislature, you also worked to put a measure before voters to establish a state ethics commission. Can you tell me why you thought an independent commission was necessary?
Well, first of all, there was none, and New Mexico at that time was one of six, I think, which did not have any kind of ethics commission. I was informed they'd been working on it for 25 years, and it baffled me as to why it would take so long simply to establish an ethics commission. I felt that there needed to be a centralized commission in order to be consistent and to give advisory opinions and to follow up and be properly staffed in order to track down any complaints that were made and have the public understand that there was a place to finally go that was not to an elected official's office, whether it be Attorney General or Secretary of State, so that they could go to the commission and make their complaints. And also, just as equally important, that legislators, state employees, elected officials could go to the commission for advisory opinions in advance so that it would help them out in order to avoid any kind of mistakes down the road. I thought that was very important also.
And Kathleen, you have something to add to that?
Well, I just want to acknowledge Representative Dines' work. By the time the enabling legislation was passed for the commission, Representative Dines was no longer in office. He was sort of the, I don't want to say victim. I don't want to victimize you, Representative Dines, but there were heavy donations by every town for gun safety that worked against his reelection. And Representative Dines laid the groundwork and worked so diligently on this and was so respected in a bipartisan way. So, Representative Dines, the New Mexico owes you a debt of gratitude for the work that you did bringing this commission into existence. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
Okay, I have a phone call from Antonia in Los Alamos who has a question for us. Good morning, Antonia.
Hi. So I have a question. I used to work for the state of New Mexico, and we have pretty strict guidelines as a state employee about taking stuff from, potential conflicts of interest like industry, because, we could be influenced, I suppose. Anyway, I was wondering if the state legislature had to abide by those same rules. And if not, why don't we just impose those same rules on state legislatures?
Okay. Kathleen, is this something you can speak to?
Well, Antonia, are you referencing the GIFT Act per se, or just in general, avoid conflict of interest through the Governmental Conduct Act?
The second one.
Okay. Because the GIFT, and so Jeremy's going to be talking about this too, because there are attempts to figure out what level of enforcement can actually happen under that Governmental Conduct Act. The GIFT Act is an interesting one, and I'll just mention this because what we're seeing $28,000 spent by this Golf Tourism Alliance for golf passes. Divide $28,000 by 112 legislators, you get $250. $250 is the limit under the GIFT Act for what a legislator, a public officer, their family can accept from someone who's trying to influence them. It's just, I don't think it's coincidence.
Okay. Does that answer your question, Antonia?
Well, we were limited to $20. I don't know where the $250 came from.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for calling in. We also have a call from Mara in Albuquerque. Good morning, Mara.
Actually, my name's Laura, and I just want to make a shout out to Willard because he's an incredible statistics person. He works tirelessly to examine what the government is doing and look at their books and stuff. He's an amazing person. But I just wanted to say, someone who grew up here and, come from family in Santa Fe, and, New Mexico has, I love this place, but it is incredibly corrupt, and it's partly because it's a very poor state, and it's easy to influence people who are living, at or below poverty level, simply because they don't have a voice. And so one of the things that I've noticed here is nobody trusts the government except their beloved, local whoever. And part of the problem is because there are so many lobbyists, but because we don't trust the government, we then don't fund, as you've pointed out, the legislators enough to give them the assistance that they would need. So the lobbyists can just sort of come in. So they've created their own environment where our lack of trust is why they can come in and take over. But one of the things I was curious about, and maybe I've just missed this, is there any kind of restrictions or efforts towards restrictions that say that any one lobbying entity can only lobby as much as any private entity? In other words, is there any kind of cap on the spending for lobbyists in terms of as a large corporate entity that could keep them from having so much monetary influence? Because, I can come in impassioned and do my Jimmy Stewart routine about, fracking or whatever. But if somebody else has, limitless funds and can send, like you said, 90 lobbyists in, what is the curbs on that so that the average citizen can have something like a balance in a state as poor as this?
Kathleen?
Well, I think Representative Dines will agree with me. There is no cap. And that's a great idea, Laura, for moving forward, establishing some kind of cap. One of the things we're seeing in this oil and gas report is there's unlimited spending. Dwarfing pretty much every other industry here in New Mexico. And the question becomes, and so when we talk about lobbying, we're also talking about lobbyists contributing to the campaigns of people, and that's where the big money has its biggest effect. And my question is, if you become so dependent on an industry for your election or defeat, then whom are you serving really when you get into that office?
Okay, thank you for your call, Laura. Now, as we mentioned, Jim Dines did advocate for the formation of a state ethics commission, and that did come into being. It just started its work this year. And joining us in the studio is Jeremy Ferris, the executive director of the State Ethics Commission. Good morning, Jeremy.
Good morning, Ty. Thank you for inviting me.
So the State Ethics Commission just officially started working on January 1st of this year, and it received its first ethics complaint last week. That specific complaint is not public yet, so we can't speak to it. But can you tell me about the kind of complaints and issues that the commission is set up to investigate?
Sure. So the commission officially began on July the 1st of last summer. It took about 6 months for the commission to come to its full complement of seven commissioners. The commission is structured in a way to where the governor appoints the chair, the leadership of the legislature appoints four other commissioners, and the legislatively appointed commissioners appoint the final two. It's necessarily bipartisan by both by constitution and by statute. And the commission has the power to adjudicate complaints alleging violations of a number of statutes and one constitutional provision, including many of the statutes that we've been discussing this morning, the Lobbyist Regulation Act, the Gift Act, the Governmental Conduct Act, the Anti-Donation Clause of the Constitution. And so the members of the public can file complaints with the State Ethics Commission alleging violations of those statutes. The commission, as Representative Dines mentioned, can also issue advisory opinions upon request as to whether or not a specific factual scenario would constitute a violation of one of the statutes under the commission's jurisdiction. And separately, the commission also has the power to go out and initiate civil state court actions to enforce the provisions of the civil provisions of the statutes over which the commission has jurisdiction.
And can you tell me how this process will work? Can you walk me through how the commission might take on a given complaint and what would happen to it once it's actually made?
Sure. So administrative complaints that can be made by any person. Under the statute, they have to be on the commission's complaint form, which we've made available on our website, sec.state.nm.us. At the moment, per statute, complaints must be signed under penalty of false statement and notarized. So the legislature has put in conditions more or less to screen out what the legislature might have feared would be frivolous complaints. Once those complaints are filed with the commission staff review them to ensure that they're within the jurisdiction of the commission, that it's not alleging a violation of a statute for which the commission doesn't have jurisdiction, for example, IPRA or OMA, but rather something that the commission does have power to enforce.
Like what is IPRA or OMA?
The Inspection of Public Records Act or the Open Meetings Act, some of the core transparency statutes in our state government. So there are very important statutes for which the commission doesn't have jurisdiction. But the most important statutes, the Governmental Conduct Act, the Gift Act, the Campaign Reporting Act, the Lobbyist Regulation Act, those statutes the commission does have jurisdiction for. So the first thing the commission does is determine that the complaint is one that it can speak to. And if that's the case, then the commission's general counsel conducts an investigation to determine whether or not the complaint is supported by probable cause. And if a complaint is supported by probable cause, at that point, a hearing officer is assigned and the complaint and all of the materials surrounding the complaint are made public. Up until the point of the general counsel's probable cause determination, all complaints that are filed with the commission and all the materials relating thereto and the investigation are confidential. But once the commission determines that there is probable cause, at that point, a complaint becomes public, a public hearing officer is assigned, and there's a hearing like any other administrative adjudicatory hearing.
Okay. And what would that look like?
That basically looks like a mini trial. Mm-hmm. And it would result in a hearing officer issuing findings of fact, conclusions of law, and appeals from hearing officer determinations go to the full commission, the seven commissioners. And the commission would render a final decision. And the commission has the power, again, to enforce the civil provisions of the statutes that we've been discussing.
Okay. You are listening to Let's Talk New Mexico on 89.9 KUNM. What questions do you have about how the new State Ethics Commission operates? Call us at 277-5866 or tweet to us using the hashtag #LetsTalkNM. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be back in a moment.
On the next Native America Calling, we'll get in between the lines of the Night Watchman book with our March Book of the Month award-winning author Louise Erdrich. This work of fiction follows a handful of characters who tackle the realities of their time, including exploitation in an urban setting. We hope you'll make plans to join us.
Weekday mornings at 11 on KUNM.
Don't have a car or truck to donate to KUNM? Well, our vehicle donation program accepts almost anything with an engine, running or not. We take scooters, motorcycles, RVs, boats, and even farm equipment. It's worth a call to see if your vehicle donation qualifies, because you get rid of whatever it is, plus get a tax deduction and a KUNM membership with one simple phone call. 888-KUNM-CAR, 888-586-6227.
Welcome back to Let's Talk New Mexico. We're talking about lobbying and ethics in the state legislature. I have a phone call from Jason in Albuquerque. Good morning, Jason. What is your question?
Well, one thing I wanted to point out for everybody, and I think this is an area that the legislature needs to address and change, is the reporting amount that the lobbyists have. And it says that lobbyists and their employers must report any spending that exceeds $500 during the legislative session. And that's just a really big leeway to have up to $500 there, you know, and it seems like they should knock that down to like $50 and have to report anything above $50. Because I would imagine a lobbyist could get a lot of work done with up to $499 leeway.
Okay, Kathleen, thoughts?
Well, you know, and I was trying to look for the specific statute, but the $500 amount, Jason, is what triggers the need for a 48-hour report during the legislative session. I believe the the regular amount requiring reporting is 100, but I can't find that exact. But the $500 amount is what triggers the need to report more than $500 of spending within 48 hours of that spending during the legislative session.
Does that answer your question, Jason?
That's interesting.
Okay, well, thank you so much for calling in. Now, Jeremy Ferris of the State Ethics Commission, I want to go back to you. Is the State Ethics Commission concerned with any sorts of lobbying complaints?
Sure, Ty. The Ethics Commission does have jurisdiction to enforce the Lobbyist Regulation Act and the GIFT Act. To Jason's question, it is the case that lobbyists have to report individual expenditures of more than $100 on meals or entertainment or other categories. But there does need to be some statutory work to align the reporting requirements to ensure the public can ensure compliance with the GIFT Act. So under the GIFT Act, a legislator cannot knowingly give and a legislator cannot knowingly accept and a lobbyist cannot knowingly give a gift of a market value of greater than $250. In addition to that, under the GIFT Act, lobbyists cannot give gifts that have an aggregate value of $1,000 or more in a calendar year to any particular legislator. So those two provisions of the GIFT Act actually should work to constrain the amount of lobbying dollars that go to legislators. But it might be the case right now that the information that's being collected under the Lobbyist Regulation Act is insufficient to ensure compliance with the GIFT Act. And I'll add this, Ty, and to Jason's question. The commission has jurisdiction for GIFT Act violations. If a group like New Mexico Ethics Watch or other advocacy groups or members of the public that are tracking dollars to ensure compliance with the Lobbyist Regulation Act or the GIFT Act, if they suspect a violation of the law, the Ethics Commission now exists to adjudicate those alleged violations.
Okay, and now Jeremy, I want to go back to the life of a complaint in the Ethics Commission. You stated that complaints are not made public until a probable cause is found. First of all, what would constitute probable cause?
The definition of probable cause that the general counsel will use to conduct the investigations tracks the same definition from kind of Fourth Amendment law. The kind of search and seizure law that's in the federal constitution. Sure. In the New Mexico state constitution. In a sense, what the general counsel will do will conduct as thorough as an investigation, as an exhaustive of an investigation as the general counsel can, and that can also be supported by the commission's ability to seek subpoenas. Our subpoena judge is Judge Martin down in Las Cruces. The commission can go to Judge Martin for subpoenas for information and for testimony to augment the general counsel's investigation. But once the general counsel has the full view of evidence as to whether or not there's a violation before the general counsel, essentially the general counsel makes the determination whether it's more likely than not, given the full weight of all of the evidence in front of him or her, that there is a violation. And if the full breadth of the evidence suggests that it is more likely than not, then the general counsel makes that determination. The complaint is made public, and a public hearing officer is assigned, and a hearing will be had.
Now, what is the rationale for keeping them confidential prior to that point?
I think the legislature was concerned when drafting the enabling legislation of political opponents or whomever filing complaints and then immediately running, I suppose, to the papers and announcing, I've just alleged an ethics violation against some legislator. Now, the individual still can do that. But I think by keeping the process confidential for a while before the probable cause determination, it enables the commission to make something of a more legitimate decision that when a complaint is released, is made public, it comes with a kind of imprimatur that the commission does believe that there is an actual violation here. Otherwise, the commission might be swamped by media coverage of just a particular complaint in the event that the materials weren't made public. I mean, journalists like yourself could submit a per request and get the briefing related to a complaint without the commission having the ability to investigate it on its own without that kind of pressure.
Now, former Representative Jim Dines, when you were helping to visualize the State Ethics Commission, you advocated for a more open process. Could you tell me why you believe that complaints should be public from their point of filing?
Absolutely. If you go back in history, before the establishment of the Ethics Commission, what you could do is any member of the public could file with the Secretary of State's office a complaint. That complaint at that time would be public record and subject to public review. I don't see any reason that system should not continue, because simply right now, if you file an action or a lawsuit in court, unless it's sealed, which takes a lot to do these days by the judges, then it can be reported by the media or by anyone, because it's a public record. I don't see any distinction or difference with this particular procedure here. And the other part is, they've got wonderful commissioners, a wonderful staff. I think it's off on a good start. But the problem that I see is when you have one person, the general counsel, who's in a position to be the gatekeeper and decide yes or no if the matter goes forward, but then the public has no way to see that from an accountability standpoint, I think that kind of secrecy is quickly outweighed by the public's right to know. And I think that then what you've got is what I had envisioned as a transparent commission. You then have decisions being made behind closed doors early on in the process, and therefore you're never going to know if complaints were filed. My proposal was simply file a complaint and then hold it for the 30-day response period and then have both of them disclosed by the Ethics Commission at the same time. And I felt that that was a reasonable compromise, but I found that the legislature simply did not want to make matters public, and they established the procedure this way. And actually, the rest of it's a very good process, and I know Jeremy's going to do a great job, but I think that one part that funnels through one gatekeeper, I think that that is something that is very disturbing to me as someone as an advocate for transparency.
Jeremy, thoughts?
The Representative Dines makes several good points there. The worry is perhaps the secrecy worry is perhaps not as great as he suggests. A lot of the complaints that the commission will receive will likely come from the Secretary of State's office. We have shared jurisdiction for about four statutes: the Campaign Reporting Act, the Financial Disclosure Act, the Lobbyist Regulation Act, and the Voter Action Act. Complaints that start with the Secretary of State's office, as Representative Dines points out, are public, and so they're public from the get-go, even when they're referred over to the Ethics Commission for adjudication. So the secrecy worry isn't necessarily as strong as Representative Dines suggests. And second, just to defend the general counsel here a bit, the general counsel is a very important role in the State Ethics Commission Act. The general counsel is a position that's making the most sensitive determination in the adjudication of administrative complaints, whether or not a complaint should be set for a public hearing, whether or not it's supported by probable cause. Now, the general counsel is very insulated, Ty and Representative Dines, from politics. The legislators appoint the commissioners hire the executive director hires the general counsel. That structure ensures that the general counsel is insulated from the political forces of the legislature and can make impartial decisions.
Okay, thank you, Jeremy, for explaining that. Now, something that we have been speaking about this morning is the nature of New Mexico's legislature as a citizen body, meaning that our legislators are not paid a salary. Joining us by phone is Senator Antoinette Cedillo-Lopez, a Democrat. She supported Senate Joint Resolution 7, which would have given the State Ethics Commission the ability to set legislative salaries, but did not pass. Good morning, Senator Cedillo-Lopez.
Good morning.
So New Mexico is the only state in the country that does not pay its legislators a salary. Could you tell us why you supported a resolution that would have changed that?
Well, one of the things I noticed joining the legislature last year is that a lot of us are retired, which is in my case. And then other people have jobs that, like me, a lot of lawyers have their own firms and they can just leave at will. Or some of them actually tried to practice while they were in the legislature, which really amazed me, but they were able to do it. And then there were people who owned an oil and gas company or were otherwise pretty wealthy. And you notice in the Senate especially, legislators tend to be older, like me, retired, because if you're trying to raise a family, it's very disruptive and to any kind of career, and of course there's no money in it. And I remember talking to a sixth grade class. One of the students asked me, well, how can I grow up to be a state senator? And I felt weird telling her, well, it really isn't a career in New Mexico. It's something that you'll have to do, find something to support yourself with, and then do it on the side, which I just thought was disappointing.
Okay, Kathleen, is this consistent with your experience?
In terms of the conflicts composition of the mm-hmm. of the legislature,
right? As
absolutely.
Well, as the conflicts
there's
of interest.
There's also. And good morning, Senator. But there's also some interesting carve out for teachers and public school employees who are able to get up there as well. And thank goodness for that. But yes, absolutely.
Okay. And Senator, why would the State Ethics Commission be an appropriate body to determine salaries if this measure would have gone through?
I think it's important that we not determine our own salaries. Because I think Congress has gotten out of hand with the kind of benefits and sort of special things that Congress gets. And it's kind of natural I wanted to avoid the self-interest. And so I thought the Ethics Commission would be a good independent body to research what's fair, what makes sense. I would advocate a reasonable salary. I don't think that you should get rich becoming a legislator. It is a service project. And of course, it doesn't really affect me, but it will affect the person coming behind me and the people who run for this office. And so that's why I support it.
And do you have a sense for why the resolution did not pass this last session?
Well, I like to think that it was a 30-day session and it was just too crowded and controversial, and there's just too much going on. It's going to continue to get introduced, and I really believe that eventually we'll get it done. I do think that there is an element that likes the idea of or who thinks that maybe they will have more opponents if it's paid, because honestly, not very many people can afford to do this. And I think that that's the wrong way to look at it. I think you have to look at it as what's the best for New Mexico. And apart from the salary issue, I think it's actually more important that we get staff. One of the things you'd talk about is the influence you've been talking about is the influence of lobbyists. Well, a lot of times, lobbyists are the ones explaining how the bill works to us. And I know with the ETA bill, that was a very, very complex bill. And so I had PNM lobbyists, I had New Energy Economy lobbyists, I had all of these people explaining the bill. And here I'm reading it and trying, because it's very complex, very technical. And I really would have liked an independent staff to be helping me get through this I think it was like 86-page bill. And so that's the kind of thing that I think would really help us be more independent and more effective, would be a paid staff.
Okay. Now, I do have to ask, so another important aspect of open government is the public's ability to see what happens during open meetings. This session, you did tell a TV reporter to leave a committee meeting at the Roundhouse because they didn't get prior permission to record. Why should journalists be restricted from covering open meetings?
Well, actually, I also was a co-sponsor of the bill to open it up and allow and not require the media. And that resolution actually passed. I didn't know the history of that resolution. I was temporarily chairing a meeting. And, you know, I'm one of these individuals who believes in the rule of law, that you comply with a rule unless you challenge it in court or unless you change it, which I was very happy we were able to change it. Or you conscientiously object. I didn't think conscientious objective was appropriate in that instance, only because they're webcast and they're archived. So mm-hmm. I didn't think that there was anything hidden about it. But I agree with you. I thought the rule was kind of stupid. And so I co-sponsored with Senator Steinborn the ultimate resolution that changed it. And I was really pleased to do it. I don't think that there's any kind of legislative meeting that should be confidential or closed to the media.
Okay. Well, thank you for answering that question. We are coming to the end of the program today. That is all the time that we have. Thanks to everyone who called in to share your thoughts. Thanks so much to our guests, Kathleen Sabo, Jeremy Ferris, Jim Dines, and Senator Antoinette Cedillo-Lopez. Let's keep this conversation going. Share your thoughts on Twitter, hashtag Let's Talk NM, or on Facebook, search for KUNM Radio, or email letstalk@KUNM.org. If you missed part of the show, you can stream it online or subscribe to our podcast. You can find that wherever you find your favorite podcasts. I'm Ty Bannerman. Our engineer is Marino Spencer. Taylor Velasquez screened your calls. Bryce Dix live tweeted, and Kevin McDonald with our media partner, New Mexico PBS, live streamed the show today. Our executive producer is Hannah Colton. This is Let's Talk New Mexico at 89.9 KUNM.